observational knowledge is that we have this big landscape.
That's conservative.
Yes.
And that this landscape contains number of vacua that allow for eternal inflation. And these two things together lead to the picture of the eternally inflating multiverse, where the observable physics varies from place to place. Now, of course, there's big gaps in our understanding, and this conclusion might be wrong. But what I'm going to do today is I'm just going to assume that this picture is right, and I'm going to pursue predictions and see if this picture really fits together self-consistently. Of course, we want to also have a much better, more rigorous understanding of all of this, but because that's proven so difficult, I think there is some value in taking a more phenomenological approach as well. Now, of course, the reason that we take any of this picture seriously is because of Weinberg. If I could describe very briefly in modern language,
sorry,
Weinberg's calculation. Weinberg focused on a particular part of the multiverse. The part of the multiverse which is identical to what we observe, except for the cosmological constant. So he allowed one parameter to vary. And, of course, most regions that are like our vacuum, if our understanding of the cosmological constant is correct, have a cosmological constant that's order one in Planck units. But in predicting the observed, cosmological constant, it makes sense to focus on the regions that have observers. I think there might be some principle being used here. And, of course, the observation that is now famous is that holding all other parameters fixed, structure formation is disrupted if the cosmological constant is much bigger than 10 to the minus 120 in Planck units. On the other hand, and the reason that this was predictive, is that you need additional fine-tuning in order to get a cosmological constant that's much smaller than 10 to the minus 120 in Planck units. And therefore, most observers should see a cosmological constant which is in the vicinity of 10 to the minus 120. And this prediction was dramatically confirmed. Now, this raises a big question, though. And the big question that it raises is, what happens when we allow more parameters to vary? As a concrete example that people have worried about, the Weinberg prediction is very sensitive to the magnitude of the density perturbations. And if our understanding of the landscape is correct, of course, all parameters, not just the density perturbations and the cosmological constant, could vary in the multiverse. And so, in particular, I want to focus. So this is a reason to be concerned about how robust this prediction is. Okay? Is this just an accident? Or is this something, is this a prediction that continues to make sense when we think about the entire landscape rather than just this one slice through the landscape? And in particular, I want to focus on two questions. Once all parameters are allowed to vary, where does the cosmological hierarchy between the cosmological constant scale and the Planck scale come from? And, well, at least in our paper, we credit Joe with bringing attention to this question. The second question that I want to ask is a question that was not addressed so much here. I want to address the cosmological coincidence. Can we explain the cosmological coincidence that the matter density today is so close to the cosmological constant energy density today? Okay? A way I'm going to write this is T lambda is the time when the cosmological constant starts to dominate. And that's very close to the time when we happen to be living right now. Can we explain this thing? At the level of this Weinberg explanation, it's surprising that these things are so close to each other, because the physics that controls what the cosmological constant should be is not just this consideration that structure formation should not be disrupted. Well, on the other hand, the physics that controls when observers arise includes galaxy cooling, evolution, and all kinds of other messy things. So is there some reason that we should expect to see this? And so what I want to emphasize is that I'm going to allow all parameters to vary. Includes what?
Microwave temperature.
I'm going to let everything vary.
In the middle of that interstellar space time, too.
Okay, you got me. I'm not going to allow that to vary. Now, in order to make any prediction in eternal inflation, we need a measure. And what I'm going to tell you is that one simple measure, the light cone time measure, which I'll describe briefly, plus some mild qualitative assumptions about the landscape, will allow us to answer these questions. And what I'm going to find is that the geometry, without any reference to details about structure formation, just the geometry of this cutoff explains the coincidence why we're living at the time that the cosmological constant starts to dominate. And I'm going to find that the hierarchy between the Planck scale and the cosmological constant scale is ultimately set by the number of vacua in the landscape. In a rather particular way, that the cosmological constant goes like 1 over a quantity n bar. And n bar I'm going to refuse to, I'm going to define more carefully later. But to tell you roughly what I mean, n bar is the effective number of vacua in the landscape. What I mean by this is there might be a whole bunch of vacua that are that we could essentially ignore because it's very difficult to tunnel to them. And there might be another set of vacua that we can ignore because it's exponentially difficult to make any observers in those. I'm going to exclude all of those, and the rest of them is going to be n bar. Okay? I'm going to assert that that's a finite number, and not just any finite number, but a number that's about 10 to the 123.
You're making a prediction about the UV complete theory of the multiverse.
That's right. Or to say it another way, with my assumptions about the theory, I predict that the cosmological constant is set by this, and then comparison with observation will tell us whether this theory is correct or not.
By n bar, you don't mean literally the number of vacua. You mean like the number that's accessible from something or something.
That's what I just said. Maybe you were distracted because of the previous boring aspect of my talk.
What do you actually mean by accessible? Or do you have a more precise definition?
Yeah, well, so we'll come to a slightly more precise definition.
So you're not predicting lambda, you're using measurements to value n-bar.
Well, you could put it either way around. The way I would say it is I'm analyzing the predictions of the theory, and the prediction of the theory is this.
Right.
That we observe this value. And then we can compare that to observation.
But what if there are other features of nature that seem to require an improper prediction explanation besides lambda, like nuclear physics or something?
No, that's right. So this is going to be consistent with that. In other words, what I said. Well,
you don't have vacua there if you need to more than lambda.
That's right, and that's crucial. Let me describe later why that can still happen. But I mean, at this stage, I just said. I mean, this is the effective number of vacua, okay? So vacua where nuclear physics is screwed up and so it's hard to make observers, ignore those. Don't include that in n bar, okay? And I'll come to a slightly more precise way of defining it later. Okay. So, all right, so that's what's going to happen. Now, let me start by just describing very briefly what I see as the measure problem. It's become clear that there is some confusion or just disagreement about what the measure problem is. And this is my measure problem. So if the fundamental theory gives a large multiverse with diverse observable physics, then it's natural to make predictions by counting. All right, this is not yet specific to internal inflation, just to a very large universe. And to count to predict the probability of measuring different values of the cosmological constant, we can just count the number of observations of different values of the cosmological constant. Okay? Now, I'm using a semi-classical language here. We could put this in a more quantum language. But this is the basic idea. And if the universe were extremely large but finite, this formula would make sense. Okay? Now, there's an encouraging fact about eternal inflation, which is that if you count the relative number of events of any kind, this approaches a constant at late time, which is independent of initial conditions. But there's also a discouraging fact about eternal inflation, which is that this attractor behavior so the late time limit of this ratio and this attractor behavior depends on the choice of time variable. So if you choose some time variable, you'll have some attractor behavior that will be independent of initial conditions. But it depends on your choice of time variable. That's your choice. Okay? And so this quantity that I wanted to use to make predictions is just ambiguous at this level, okay? And
So, you know, within, I think it's completely clear that within general relativity or perturbative quantum gravity, it's clear that there's no preferred time variable. The theory is diffeomorphism invariant. Okay? And so this ratio is just ill-defined. It's not a gauge invariant quantum. Okay? So there might be some things that you can compute in perturbative quantum gravity, and it might be productive to figure out which things are well-defined, but I'm pretty sure that my favorite quantity is not well-defined. So why do I persist in talking about it if it's not well-defined? That there are hints that this thing is well defined in the full theory. And basically, this is of course not something I can prove. Of the semi-classical description, when we're trying to describe more than one horizon region, when we're trying to describe a region of space-time that's larger than what any single observer can observe in principle. This divergence arises from...
Is that the only thing I
have told you? Of course not.
All right, so this divergence comes from counting things that are not accessible to any given observer. So outside...
Your conclusion would be that non-perturbatively quantum gravity is diffeomorphism invariant, maybe only in some restricted sense.
Well, that might be too crude of a way of putting it, but I think something that maybe would sound plausible to a lot of people, including me, is that, you know, in eternal inflation we have all these different pockets and so on, and we're counting these guys independently from these guys. Okay? Now what I would say is that, you know, in black holes we learned that really, you know, things inside the horizon are not really independent from things outside the horizon. I think what's pretty likely here is that things over here are not really independent from things over there. Okay? And so something about this counting that gives infinity is not...
ADSCFT or DSCFT, you know, the diffeomorphisms that are actual symmetries are only ones that act trivially out of infinity. So this could be totally consistent with some DSCFT reasoning.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point.
So then Alan seems really attached to these infinities, though. And I'm just curious if you're gonna, do you know to be deviating from his beliefs about how eternal inflation works, or are you gonna comment on that?
I don't think I have anything. I could talk to you privately about Alan's beliefs, but I don't have any.
It's not just that these are infinite, it's that they're exponentially growing.
Alan
thinks he needs that.
Let's talk about that later. Okay. So I think there is some reason to hope. So my conclusion from this and from the analogy with black holes is that these things are actually finite in the full theory. Okay, this may turn out to be wrong, but I think it's a plausible belief based on what we know.
So the numbers are finite, or only the ratios are finite?
Well, what's important to me is the ratios.
Okay.
Alright, so my guess is that NA over NB, so my conclusion is that NA over NB is well-defined, ultimately.
Your conclusion or your
That is my conclusion from what I know, and of course we don't know the full answer. My guess. Alright. Here's my guess. Now, as you all know, we don't know how to derive from first principles what the correct value is for this ratio. Okay? And so we're in a situation where if we want to try to make some kind of predictions, then we need to make a guess for how to regulate these infinities. Okay? And I'm going to just tell you very briefly the guess that I'm going to be focusing on today. Oh, let me back up for a second. So this work here was done with Rafael Busso, Stefan Leichenauer, who's here, and Vladimir Rosenhaus, who will be showing up at some point. And we actually considered other various cutoffs and many more things in this paper, but I'm going to try to talk about something that's tractable to present in the next however long I have. Okay, so today what I'm going to do is I'm going to use one particular measure, the light cone time cutoff. And I'm going to focus attention until the end on vacua with positive cosmological constants. Okay? And I'll come back later to tell you the situation with negative cosmological constants. Okay, now this cutoff is defined in a way similar to what Alex was describing yesterday in terms of a UV cutoff in the boundary theory. The UV cutoff in the boundary theory leads to some kind of infrared cutoff in the bulk. The picture is roughly this. This is the cutoff scale in the boundary theory. We keep any bulk event whose future light cone is larger than this. Okay? Our detailed prescription for how to go from the bulk to the boundary is slightly different from what Alex was describing, but it's a very similar kind of framework here. And this cutoff was described in the paper by with these same authors. Now, I've defined this very, very carefully here, and that's because there's a different formulation of this cutoff, which remarkably is equivalent. So there's a global local duality between this description in terms of a global time cutoff. And this relationship was described by Rafael Busso and by Ishan, who's here. This is equivalent to just counting events in one causal patch. It's equivalent to restricting to one causal patch with particular initial conditions. Those initial conditions are approximately that the field should start out in the most stable vacuum in the landscape. So the picture is basically like this. There was a global picture here. In the local picture, we have some large, we just restrict to one causal patch, and the initial conditions for this causal patch are that the field starts in the most stable vacuum.
Won't your vacuum have positive cosmological constants or not?
Sorry, the most stable vacuum with positive cosmological constant.
But your hats, your little hats, do they also have positive lambda?
This one that I'm drawing has positive lambda, and what I'm focusing on today is positive lambda. But I will come to the, of course, in the landscape, I do believe we have other values at play. Okay, so it's remarkable that this cutoff, which was described globally, which was motivated by the UVIR connection, turns out to be equivalent to just restricting to one causal path, which was motivated by the lessons of black hole physics.
Is that some short way to see this? I mean, it seems like a strong statement.
Mm-hmm. I guess you'll have to ask Ishai. There are some relatively elegant ways of showing this equivalence, but nothing that I can say in the next 30 seconds.
But the other way of thinking about it doesn't require initial condition, is that right?
Yeah, so this cutoff, in terms of a global cutoff, this is some procedure for taking a lifetime cutoff. And that result will be independent of initial conditions.
But it will only agree with this.
It'll only agree with this thing. So if you just restrict to one causal path, the answer you get is dependent on initial conditions. And so you need to put in particular initial conditions, which are basically given by this attractive behavior in this particular time variable.
If you took any global prescription and then you restricted it to what's going on in a causal path, you get some answer, right?
But it might be pretty ugly. I mean, if you take some other thing that seems natural in the global point of view, it'll look like, oh, well, you don't count things in one causal path, you count it in some region with a complicated shape
Could it be
a different set of initial conditions for causal patches? Does that map something?
I think not. I mean, there's a set of things you can get by just changing these initial conditions, but it's not everything.
But there must be some restrictions on the initial conditions, right? Because if not all initial conditions allow you to have a stable vacuum positive cosmological constant can crunch. If you put too much information initially, you won't end up in the city.
That's right. So this is special initial conditions, which are empty, and it's empty de Sitter space in a particular vacuum that's very stable. Okay. And roughly where that's coming from is that if you go to late times here, I'm using the correct time variable, most of that volume is just empty de Sitter space sitting in the most stable vacuum. Okay, that's roughly where this comes from. So that's the... I'm going to use this version because this is a much more tractable version to think about, but it's equivalent to that.
Ben, let me ask you about this equivalence a little more. So it would be truly remarkable if these two things would be equivalent. But as you say, with this simple initial conditions, the equivalence is only approximate. So in order to get precise equivalence, you have, for the causal patch formulation, you have actually to go to the global description to find the attractive behavior and then take that back and use that as the initial distribution for your ensemble. So then it doesn't become so remarkable because you already used input from the other formulation.
Well, yeah, you are putting something in here. I agree with that.
So then it is not really such a striking thing. But then another thing is that... Okay. But another thing is that is it true that the equivalence is only restricted to DS bubbles, but if you go to ADS bubbles...
In ADS bubbles, you're violating my rule here, but in ADS bubbles, I think there are difficulties with this. You know, this idea of a holographic theory that lives on future infinity, that's well motivated for de Sitter bubbles. It's not well motivated for crunching bubbles. I mean, one describes some possible ideas for where a dual theory could live, and it's not on the crunch. So I think we need some to do something different for many reasons when there's a negative cosmological constant.
Let's see, let me understand one thing. So in this Lycon time cutoff, you first fix the number of bubbles you have, and then you decide to go to distance of order epsilon from the boundary?
No, I mean, you just... Well, space-time could be, it will continue to make more and more bubbles, and This is just some cutoff procedure.
No, but you imagine laying down a classical bubble distribution.
You could do that. Yeah, you could probably also do it incrementally, but the simplest situation is to lay down the semi-classical space-time with all of its infinite bubbles, and then take the cutoff procedure. But
so you can do that. This cutoff, you're removing bubbles which are smaller than the size of the cutoff.
Well,
you're forbidding bubbles which are smaller than the size of the cutoff.
I mean, they're not.
Or integrated amount.
They nucleate later than the cutoff, and so here's the cutoff, and fine. There's let's use the simplest prescription, where we just already have this space-time. So there's some bubble up here, but I'm not counting anything in there, so I don't care about it yet. When I take the cutoff to a smaller length scale, then I'll start to count things in there.
So you have to make some gauge choice for the measure of the square plus, like this.
That's right. So I was being sketchy about this because Alex talked about it yesterday, and I want to get on to addressing my questions here. But yes, in order to make this UBIR connection work, obviously you have to fix this this conformal ambiguity in the boundary metric, and the thing we proposed in this paper, which now Alex has given a much better motivation for. Well, Alex and we have proposed this in various ways at various times. this is the proposal to take a boundary Ricci scalar and make that a constant. But yes, you have to make a gauge choice in order to implement this UBIR.
It's more than a conformal factor, isn't it? I'm still confused by that point.
No, it's a conformal factor. Let's talk about that. Okay, I need to move on to the next part here. Okay, so I would be thrilled to discuss the details of these measures in more detail. But so let me try to convince you that something works or has a pretty good chance of working in terms of addressing this hierarchy and coincidence problems. Okay. So I want to get on to counting the observers. All right. So I want to count observers in the causal patch. Observers are going to live in these open FRW universes. Okay. These bubbles are characterized. I want to keep track of two things. I want to keep track of T lambda, which is 1 over the square root of the cosmological constant. All right, that's the late-time cosmological constant. That's a property of this bubble. And I want to also keep track of Tc. And Tc is the time when curvature, the FRW time, when curvature dominates over matter. Now, if there's a cosmological constant, the curvature might never dominate, but Tc is still defined to be the time when curvature would dominate if the cosmological constant were not there. And so to write down something concrete, these bubbles are characterized by an FRW equation. They have some matter. They have a cosmological constant. And they have some negative curvature. Okay?
So there's no inflation in the bubbles?
There is inflation, but at late times, sorry, I should have said that. I'm going to assume that these bubbles have inflation. But at late times, after inflation is over, when the observations are made, there are three factors: late time cosmological constant, some matter, and some curvature.
T lambda is a constant.
T lambda is a constant within the bubble. Yes. Now you could put in some radiation and so on. You can add various bells and whistles, but it's not going to change anything really. Okay. And now what I want to do is I want to label observations by three quantities. I want to label them by the FRW time when that observation is made, the thing that is 13.7 billion years for us. I want to label them by Tc, the time when curvature would dominate in that bubble. We don't know what that is, except that we don't know that curvature. We know that curvature is pretty small today. And by T lambda, the cosmological constant in the bubble. I'm not going to keep track of other information of all the other information that's in there. Okay. Now, of course, there's an orthogonal question here of, you know, what precisely I mean by observations, but that's something that I can avoid for today. Now, I want to write down the probability distribution. Okay, the probability of observing these three values is proportional to the number of observations. So I'm going to count the number of observations.
So
write
so
down
you
the probability distribution.
C and B.
Sorry?
You said you were going to include the C and B, but not, but
I just said I was going to allow the CMB temperature to vary.
Okay, but is
it? It varies.
It's going to, okay.
It's hidden in there.
Okay.
I'm not going to predict the CMB temperature, though. So it's kind of integrated out from the beginning. But you'll see what assumptions are being made here. I don't think I've really made too many yet. And for whatever reason, it's convenient to write this in terms of the logs of these things. And let's just think about this being in Planck units. Okay. So you don't like to write down the log of the dimensionable quantity.
So Ben, sorry to interrupt one more time. Why does curvature have to dominate ever?
I said that, but I didn't write it down. So the curvature may never dominate. But TC is defined as the time when the curvature would dominate.
It's the right coefficient
for
that
curvature. If there were no cosmological constant. So TC is defined as the coefficient.
Is this a replacement for the number of refoldings during the...
That's something I should mention, which is that TC is exponential in the number of refoldings.
Yeah,
right.
So it's a replacement for
slow rule inflation. Yeah, so that's right. That's why we have that parameter. Well, and because also... You know, in the same way that we'd like to explain why we don't see a large cosmological constant, we'd like to explain why we don't see large curvature, because in some sense it takes fine tuning to make the curvature so small. All right, so now I'm going to split up this probability into two parts. This first part is just the probability distribution over bubbles. The probability to nucleate a bubble with the parameters T lambda and TC. The next part is going to be the mass that's inside the cutoff region of a bubble with T lambda, TC, and T observer. Okay, so this mass, if you take some FRW time here, this mass is the total mass that's contained inside there. And then alpha, which depends on all three of these parameters, and alpha is number of observations per unit mass per logarithmic time interval. Okay? Now, at this point I'm just rewriting this. Why is this at all useful? So this is useful because so this factor, this is just the probability to nucleate a bubble with certain properties. And this thing, we know enough about the landscape. This is one of the only things we know enough about the landscape to guess what the probability distribution is over the cosmological constant and over the curvature. Okay? I'll tell you in a moment what my guess is. And really, that's why we even kept track of the curvature, because it's something we know enough to make a guess about what its probability distribution is. This thing, we can compute. Okay, just, you know, using the Friedmann equation, we know the energy density, we can compute this mass. Okay? And now this alpha is where I've hidden a lot of the complications, but one thing I can say is that this alpha is independent of the choice of measure.
So sorry, how are you going to... Okay. The first factor, you kind of quickly said that you could get that from what we know about the landscape.
Yeah, I'm coming to that. Yeah.
Because that entails knowing the distribution of the number of refoldings and inflation.
I'm coming to that. Very soon. So this is independent of the measure. This is just the number of observations per unit mass per logarithmic time interval. Okay? And the simplification that I want to make about alpha before answering Eva's question is that, so another. In the regime where the observations happen long before curvature or the cosmological constant dominates, then it's very natural to assume that this alpha is only a function of the time when the observations are made, because the curvature and the cosmological constant are not dynamically important at that point. Okay, so it's only a function of one variable. If, on the other hand, we consider observations where Tc or T lambda are smaller than T observer, we kind of know that having the cosmological constant dominate earlier makes it more difficult to make observers. It disrupts structure formation. It does all kinds of annoying things. And so what we can do is we can overcount the observers in that region by continuing to assume, by ignoring those deleterious effects of cosmological constant domination, and pretending that the observations are made just as before. And the reason we can get away with this is that these overcounted observers, these people who are living long after the cosmological constant dominates, will turn out to be relatively rare anyway because of this simple geometrical factor m that we can compute. Okay? And so this is the thing that I'm going to analyze, is this distribution. All right? So I've made an assumption. So this is the argument that allows me to make this just a function of T observer. Okay. So now let's come to this first factor here, the probability distribution over the curvature and the cosmological function. So first of all, to keep you in suspense a little longer, I think we know that the distribution over the cosmological constant is one, is flat for very small values of the cosmological constant because of the usual arguments. And what that means is, in terms of my variable, is that in terms of log T lambda, this goes like 1 over T lambda squared. And that's just a change of variables. All right, now what about the curvature? So the curvature is set, of course, by the number of E foldings.
See, why couldn't I have said that the probability for lambda is given by the Hartle-Hawking factor, for example?
That would conflict with observation. Yeah, then you would have some exponential thing which very strongly favors very small lambda, and we would have no idea why we had such a large inflationary cosmological constant. I mean, that would certainly conflict with this and really this whole kind of statistical prediction for the cosmological constant. I think that's just a different.
But that distribution, I mean, that distribution, you can obtain it in a couple of different ways, which is one of which is the original Hartle-Hawking derivation, and the other one is the.
That's right, and it predicts it out of the universe. Yeah. So it is a very nice distribution for something.
Well, maybe you're throwing out
the
theory.
Sorry?
Maybe you're throwing out the prediction that rules out the theory.
I mean, I think if the Hartle-Hawking wave function is relevant to computing the current cosmological constant, then certainly what I'm doing is wrong, and I think very likely that what would not agree with observation. But yeah.
When you're asking T lambda equals 1, you're estimating some counting of number of vacuum.
Right.
That's what that's coming from.
Yeah.
Just counting the number of vacuum.
Yeah, this is just counting vacuum.
Just counting.
Well, so this is the probability to nucleate a bubble with these parameters. So it includes some dynamics as well.
But the T lambda equals 1. That's just counting?
That's asking the question, when you nucleate a bubble, what's the probability distribution over the lifetime cosmological constant? Okay? So first of all, we think in the landscape that, at least for vacua with its significant supersymmetry breaking, the distribution of vacua is flat near lambda equals 0. And furthermore, the dynamics, because it suddenly happens in the whole universe, the dynamics is not sensitive to late-time cosmological constant rate. So there's going to be no special feature at lambda equals 0.
So that's an up-tunneling event?
No.
Event, no? Didn't you have the most stable vacuum in the bottom? And
The most stable vacuum probably has a cosmological constant that's larger than ours. But I don't know that for sure. There could be change. Look, there are some, there could be a number of decays and so on here, okay? And, I mean, the dynamics of this situation where you start with the most stable vacuum is something that's been analyzed pretty well, and I'm simplifying in this picture, but not in a way that affects this at all, okay? So this is really the probability to, you know, for some chain of decays that leads to a vacuum that's with this value of the cosmological constant.
Well, is it so clear that it's the cosmological constant that's vacuum there? I mean, you could argue with this to be, you know, almost supersymmetric, so that
I think it's not totally clear. And in that case, the picture is going to be that you start in the most stable vacuum, and then you, well, regardless, really the picture is that you start in the most stable vacuum, then you tunnel up to something, and then you tunnel down from there to our vacuum. And I could tell you why I think that's the right picture. And, there are some things we would like to know about tunneling rates in the landscape that could have an impact on these conclusions. Okay, all right, now, are you ready? Okay, now the number of e-folding. Okay, so Lenny and I and Matt Cleveland and so on analyzed this question, and Maria Martinez. We analyzed this question. We found that the probability distribution of the number of e-foldings goes like 1 over the number of e-foldings to the fourth power.
It sounds very limited form of the potential.
Okay. I think what's a correct statement. Ah, okay. Liam and collaborators did some fancy numerics in a different corner of the landscape of flux compactifications with throats and so on.
These are similar potentials. These are looking
and they found like that this goes like 1 over n e 3 plus or minus 0.05 at 1 sigma.
Let me explain the special assumption you're making. You're assuming small field inflation with a little inflection point.
Okay, here's your chance. What is your distribution?
I think we don't know, and we should not pretend like we know. And I think that the there are Wilsonian natural methods for inflation that are not fine tuned. This is basically an estimate of how much fine tuning you think you might need to do inflation. The question is complicated enough that we don't have a conclusion yet about.
I completely agree with that. I wasn't trying to claim that this is something that we know. I think what's a very plausible assumption about this is that this goes as 1 over n e to some power. That's positive. Okay? The reason is that if it's exponential, if it takes exponential fine-tuning for inflation, then basically inflation doesn't work. The fine-tuning you have to do for the potential cancels out.
You don't have to do fine-tuning for the potential. It's natural in the Wilsonian sense if you have a shift symmetry.
I didn't say that.
Okay.
What I said is if the tuning were exponential to get a lot of e-folding,
yeah,
then inflation wouldn't really solve the flatness problem. Okay. So it has to be a power law. Now, the question is, does it take any tuning of the potential or of the initial conditions or whatever to get inflation? I think it's quite plausible that there is some tuning there. Okay? And what I would advise...
Right.
Yeah.
The radiator stability... That's
I use one stroke.
Okay. Why don't you allow me to...
But maybe in a random...
We're going to run out of time before...
I think these are very plausible assumptions, but of course there's a lot of work that remains to be done on these assumptions. Okay? First what I want to do is I want to fix the time of our observations. And ask allow everything else to vary, and ask what value of T lambda and TC we should see. In that case, I can ignore this because this is a constant, and I just need to analyze this thing. Okay? Now, this mass, I don't have time to tell you, but let me just give you a rough idea. You do some computation, which is completely elementary, and you find formulas like this. The mass inside the causal diamond goes like T lambda squared over TC in the regime where T observer is less than TC is less than T lambda. And you find a bunch of other similar formulas to this in other regimes. Okay? At one stage, my collaborators had a lot of fancy hypergeometric functions in here, which I insisted on taking out because they weren't really relevant. But this is some elementary computation for the mass. Okay? And now you can multiply these two factors together. And let me just plot the situation. So here's log of TC, there's large curvature. Here's a lot of e-foldings, here's very few e-foldings. Here's log of T lambda. Okay? Now there's kind of a dividing line where different formulas like this take over. Okay? And what this picture ends up looking like, you can draw a picture of this probability distribution. And sorry, I'm not sure where this is. Maybe we can just turn this off. Okay, and so this factor here, the probability distribution over T lambda and TC, goes, for example, like 1 over TC here. And it goes like TC over T observer squared here. Okay? This just comes from my assumptions about the prior there and from this computation of the mass.
These factors don't include the DP, the ME, right?
Thank you, Stefan. So this controversial factor up here, this number of e-foldings and so on, I'm leaving that out for now. So for the moment, we're saying that any number of e-foldings is equally likely. Okay, I'm about to bring that back in. So the point is, you notice I've plotted this as a function of log, but these things are linear. Okay, so this is basically an exponential probability distribution in the logs. And therefore, what makes sense is to draw the direction that the thing is increasing, and because it's exponential, you can just follow to where the maximum is. Okay, and what these arrows look like is this. And let me just give you, so for example, this region down here, over here, this is where the cosmological constant dominates before the observer is formed. Okay? You can see that there's this exponential suppression of such a small t lambda, of such a large cosmological constant. The reason for that exponential suppression is just a simple geometric reason. When the cosmological constant dominates, things inflate exponentially, and therefore the mass inside one causal patch gets exponentially decreased. Okay? That has nothing to do with galaxy formation, has nothing to do with assuming that observers require carbon, has nothing to do with magnitude density perturbations. It's a simple geometrical effect that exponential expansion, once T lambda dominates, dilutes the matter. Okay? So there's a geometrical explanation for why we're living at a time that's smaller or equal to the time when the cosmological constant dominates. There's a similar story for the curvature here. Okay? So I think what I should do here is I should I can wrap this up very, very quickly. So there's two flat directions in this probability distribution. Okay, we've kind of taken care of the regions that are naively problematic, the regions where the cosmological constant dominates too soon. But we'd still like to have a normalizable probability distribution over the cosmological constant. Now, along this line, you can see that this line is where we live at the time that the cosmological constant dominates. And nothing is suppressing going to a large number of e-foldings. Okay? So this flat direction here, where these two flat directions, one of them along here, and one of them along here. This one is not integrable until you put in, I'm sorry, I attributed to Eva something that I was so sorry about that. If you now put in that there's some cost for more e-folding, that would make this thing integrable. Okay? Because it's only a logarithmic divergence, it's not very sensitive to you know, what exponent you prefer. Okay. So this one, so this degeneracy is lifted by the prior on the number of e-foldings. Okay. This one, on the other hand, see, now here, this degeneracy is where we're living at the time where curvature starts to dominate, and the cosmological constant becomes very, very small. Okay? This is not naively a direction you would have worried about, but it turns out that the geometry of negative curvature somehow conspires to cancel out the naive factors. And so what you would conclude from this, and there's no additional factor like this. The fact that the distribution over the cosmological constant is flat follows from very general consideration. And so this thing is an actual divergence. It's divergent in the log of the cosmological constant. Okay? Now, this divergence coming from very small cosmological constant is regulated, so I've been using this continuum distribution. This is regulated by the discrete Joule. But at some point, this continuum limit will break down. Okay? Now, this divergence is only a log divergence. Okay? So then what we predict here is that TC, what we predict at this level is that TC is similar to T observer. And those two things are much smaller than T lambda, which is driven to its maximum possible value, the minimum possible cosmological constant. Okay? Now, what ends up happening, which I won't describe, is that now we can ask, what happens when we allow T observer to vary? Okay? And with a very mild assumption that I can describe to you afterwards, we find that all three scales are pushed together. And so we find that T observer and TC and T lambda are all set by the maximum value of C lambda, the place where the discrete Joule limit cuts off this interval. Okay? And that's how we recover, first of all, this hierarchy. And second of all, this coincidence. And let me just say, so that's the good part, but I think it would be unfair not to list some of the problems. One problem is that negative cosmological constant is a problem, both theoretically and phenomenologically. Okay? And also we'd like to have derivation from first principles. All right, thank you.
I gave some example of this formula, e to the minus 3t. I explained it when I talked earlier in a different
you
language.
You did. Yes, yeah. I agree.
That's not my point, though. It's my point was that I introduced a variable or a quantity that I called q. And q is the quantity which I imagine is conserved. I think this was one of them. My point is that they differed in the prefactor.
Right.
And the most singular prefactor, as far as I can tell, at low cosmological constant came from the scale factor, from the...
That's right. And that's why we had this divergence that had
right.
to be regulated.
Right. So as far as I can tell, if you soften that up a little bit, for example, scale factor measure, or what I call the information measure, this divergence would go away.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, as things are now, to explain your coincidence, it looks to me like you have to assume that there's 123 vacuums. No, 10 to the 123 vacuums.
Yes.
So that's a coincidence.
What's a coincidence?
Hmm?
What's a coincidence?
But there are 10 to the 123 vacuums.
Well, we don't know how many there are. There's some number.
No, we don't know how many there are. You could possibly know that there are many, many more. Yeah.
Okay,
but
that's
if
right.
You saw, but if, you took, one of these other
that's right.
prefactors,
that's right.
then you'd be in much better shape. You'd be in better shape in that it wouldn't depend on...
That's right. But you'd be in worse shape in other ways.
I'm asking that as a question.
I agree. This is obviously a dangerous kind of situation here.
Yeah.
I think this measure is very well motivated, but...
That's right.
I mean, this is... This makes me nervous.
So if somebody could motivate a measure with a little softer behavior at small cosmological constants, you would...
Well, that's right, and one thing we analyzed with the scale factor, which does better in this sense, and the reason I talked about this one is just that I think it's a little more well-motivated, well-defined, but I think that's definitely, yeah, yes.
So I have a comment and a question. The comment is that if instead of horizon, you use apparent horizon,
mm-hmm.
as you also discussed in your paper,
yes.
this divergence disappears.
That's
so,
true. So yes.
There is an easy fix for that if you consider that.
Well, that's why I wanted to think about the apparent horizon.
Now, the question is, it is about this flat distribution for lambda. So if you look at find the distribution for some model landscape from rate equations, you discover that the probability, you have a discrete term, of course, of the probability changes wildly from one value of lambda to the next by a huge number of orders of magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get to the flat distribution, you have to average over some range of lambda, and then if the landscape is huge, then this range is small, much smaller than the entropic range, and you get a flat distribution on the scale mm-hmm. of the entropic range.
Right.
Now, if you want to consider the situation where the discreteness is important,
mm-hmm.
I think you're calling for another coincidence. You're calling for the coincidence that the entropic range of lambda is somehow comparable to the range over which you have to average.
I think that the fact that this is only a logarithmic divergence means that let's talk about this. I don't think that there's conditional assumption, but I am a little bit nervous about that. So I convinced myself that there wasn't, that it was natural, but
I think to follow up on Alex's question, even worse is the assumption on the distribution over e-folds. So you might imagine that that's also set by exponentially different factors, depending on how we're doing the counting, how you set the measure. I can easily imagine that because things are set by nucleation rates, there's some, you know, history where you get a certain number of e-folds that might be exponentially enhanced over another, instead of just considering how fine-tuned the potential is. There's another factor in there. And there, the anthropic window is huge. Right, because we don't care how many e-folds inflation are, as long as there's enough, we don't care. And so this averaging radius in which you assume things are relatively flat is now, you know, blown up to infinity.
Well, there's a general issue, which is that these tunneling rates have exponentials in them. If those exponentials are too strong, then you just end up saying, well, this is my favorite vacuum because I like to tunnel to it. Okay, that's not consistent with observation because we observe that a whole bunch of different things are fine-tuned, as Joe said. Okay, you got to fine-tune nuclear physics, you got to fine-tune this, you got to fine-tune that. So somehow or other, it has to work out that these exponentials are, you know, more than compensated by the large numbers of vacua or whatever. But that's a highly non-trivial thing that once we know more about tunneling rates, that we need to make sure that's right.
So another quick question. Do you know how much the answer would change if you used a different proxy for observations than mass? Say, number density of bound structures?
I wasn't using any proxy here. I'm just parameterizing things here.
But that's the way you're counting how many observations there are. You're saying that for each unit mass, there is an observation.
I didn't have a chance to describe what I did when I allowed the observer to be heard.
Okay.
I made an assumption about... qualitative assumption about the form of alpha, but it doesn't. Let's talk about this afterwards. I don't think I can.
Let's take one more question and we move on. Yeah. So, conservative estimates in string theory with this n bar numbers which are much higher than 100,000 or whatever.
You know, I did come and consult you before publishing, and.
So
he told me that this is not ruled out.
large uncertainties there. So, but you said, okay, it's not really the total memory that matters, it's like the number of sort of, you know, tunnelable
right.
Vacuum.
So, livable.
Yeah, well, livable, of course, yeah. But so, how, yeah, what defines tunnelable? Like how strong is the suppression? So,
well, I mean, I think there's.
It comes out of this most stable vacuum, right? So, it's everything that can be reached in a reasonable amount of time, or like, what is reasonable?
Yes. Well, yeah, so generally, in order to get a relatively flat distribution, in order not to have these exponential tunneling factors to drive you into some crazy vacuum, what you need to assume is that starting from the most stable vacuum, the way you get anywhere interesting is you kind of tunnel up somewhere, some high cosmological constant, and then you kind of rain down to anything you feel like. Okay? So,
yeah, but
so,
you want sort of, I mean, an N bar.
So, I mean, that would say that N bar is roughly N at that level. That you can pretty much tunnel anywhere with kind of equal suppression once you've averaged, okay? But then there's also the question of whether there's some entropic factors. I mean, so yeah, I mean, the point is that this, what happens up here, I think in principle this is a well-defined thing, and but we would need to know a lot more about tunneling rates and so on.
Okay, well, let's cut it off.